Good morning, Paul, my friend. Good morning. Come into the office. Come in.
Thank you, Dr. Herben Steffner.
Close enough. Whatever. Come on. Make a seat. Take yourself comfortable. What can we talk about today, my friend? What's on your mind?
Well, I'm still suffering from the DCOCD. You know, the DC events, I can't stop thinking about them. I've been thinking about a particular one at the moment.
It's
a big one. It's one where, you know, worlds will live, worlds will die, and the DC universe will never be the same again.
Sounds cheery.
So welcome to DCOCD, and it's our first episode, and we're going to be looking at Crisis on Infinite Earths today, which was this was the event that ran all through 1985, pretty much. So it was written by Marv Wolfman, penciled by George Perez, and Jerry Ordway finished the pencils, and Dick Giordano started them. So, you know, a big book ran for the entire year. Anyway, who are you?
I'm Mike. And I'll be joining Paul on this exciting adventure through 1985 and the Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Yeah. So what's it about? It's the 50-year-old history of the DC Universe is under attack by an antimatter villain and by Marv Wolfman. So, and this results in the multiverse being folded into one unified universe and history. Does that sum it up well for you, Mike?
That sums it up pretty well in story. Here in the real world, it was their attempt to tidy the heck up with everything. DC had far too many parallel universes and different Earths, and they wanted a clean house. And this was
multiple
their way of doing
versions
it.
Versions of characters.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. In the lead up to this, Marv Wolfman was talking behind the scenes and he really saw this as a big problem. It's debatable whether it actually was a big problem that there was a multiverse. And, you know, he said everyone was confused by continuity. You know, most people are fans of the, I mean, it's called pre-crisis now. That's how big this was. Mm. They say it probably wasn't a problem for most of them, but, you know, it was an opportunity to make things neater and, you know, have a fresh start for everything. Which isn't what happened in the end, but there were lots of comics where the Monitor appeared in the lead up to this. Marv Wolfman, you know, he seeded him in the Titans books, and you know, everyone had a. If you had a DC Universe book, you're meant to use the character, you know, at least twice in the lead up to Crisis, and sort of people did. But there was a bit of confusion about what the Monitor was and whether he was a villain or a good guy. And in fact, Marv Wolfman led the charge on being confused. But there were lots of books involved with this, but at the heart of it was a 12-issue maxi series, which was, you know, 32 pages. It got bigger and bigger as it went along. Some of the issues are very large. And, you know, fair to say, I've got to give my disclaimer, I got into the DC Universe after the Crisis. But within, you know, two or three years of it. And then I sort of went back and I collected the issues and read them. And, so that colours my opinion of it because I wasn't entrenched in the DC Universe before it changed. So I was more invested in the DC Universe after it changed, which is quite different to some people of my age who were reading it beforehand. So, Mike, what's your experience with the Crisis?
I didn't read it till well and truly after the fact. So I guess... I'm like yourself. I came along post-crisis in terms of what was going on in the DCU. But probably if you got into it only a couple of years after it happening, I was long after that because I kind of read a bit of everything and was probably more into the X-Men books from Marvel for quite some years. And it wasn't till my late teens that I really got intrigued by the DCU as a whole. I mean, I like things like Batman and the Justice League, but not enough to consistently buy it. And I can't remember what it was. I just got bored with the X-Men, probably.
can't imagine that happening.
Imagine that. Talking about needing a cleanup of a house. Anyway, so I think as I was buying more DC stuff and sort of picking up snippets about history that had happened, that's what led me to go backwards chronologically, I guess, and find out where it all kicked off. And this was like the big one for I guess, our era.
Yeah, I mean, it drew a very clear line between what has come before and what has come afterwards. And, you know, if you really wanted to, you could, you know, cut all the comic collecting at that point and say, okay, I'm only going to collect things post-crisis. Now, I have a little bit of crossover because I was into Swamp Thing, which sort of, you know, Alan Moore was on the title before the crisis. And so he was like 2/3 of the way through his run when the crisis hit. And, you know, I read a bit of Titans before that and things like that. So, There are a few titles where I was crossing the line, but most of my DC Universe collecting came after Crisis and were the, you know, most of them were the outputs of Crisis at the time. So, you know, so yeah, there were a lot of tie-in issues. So I'm not going to count them all. Someone else has, but you know, things like Blue Devil, the Omega Men, DC Comics Presents had multiple issues. There was Firestorm, Justice League of America, of course, Green Lantern, Infinity Incorporated. So, you know, and that's one thing I love about these events is they're a snapshot of where the universe was at that time. So, you know, there's every event seemed to have these titles that are part of the event that don't exist in later events because, you know, they're gone by then or they're evolved. Or so, you know, we've got the pre-crisis Superman books, etc. So my impression of these tie-in issues is very few of them are spoken with in, you know, hushed tones as being amazing. Like, very few of them are revered. Mostly it seems that, you know, because this was like the first time everyone had this edict of involve your books in the crisis, a lot of people didn't really know how or didn't really want to. And you've got all these little editorial pockets where the direction was stronger and weaker, basically. So, you know, they had something called the Red Skies crossover, which is basically where someone just did a nod towards the event by making the sky red in the background for a few panels. So, you know, that's code for a really piss-weak crossover tie-in, basically, these days. You know, we still use the term Red Skies crossover today. So, yeah, so some of that happened. But I've never heard anyone say, you know, if you read Crisis on Infinite Earths, you must read this tie-in issue. No one has ever said that as far as I've heard.
I have to agree with you. I don't think I've ever heard anyone use that phrase.
Yeah.
It's just been, just read Crisis. Just read the 12 issues. You'll be fine.
Yeah. So I guess we want to talk about what are the big deals about Crisis. So, Mike, what are your big deals in it?
Well, the first one that grabbed my attention involved Superman in that he was fluent in Japanese when he meets the new Dr. Light.
Wow.
I was like, wow, I never knew that. I mean, if he can speed read, you know, and I mean, yes, he's smart. Is he that smart? Anyway.
I'm not sure you understand the term big deal, but...
Well, give me an example. What was a big deal for you?
Let's talk in the scope of this. It takes the multiverse, which you've got, you know, Earth 3, Earth X, and, you know, Earth Shazam, and Earth Nazi, and all that, and it basically did away with all that and said, this is one universe now. And, you know, it really tried to have its cake and eat it too by saying, okay, all these characters... Some of them have died now, but most of them existed in one form or the other, except they're all in the same timeline now, so we'll try and work that out as we go. And so coming out of it, you've got, you know, a unified timeline and everyone on the same page. And, you know, as in the nature of comic book universes, that doesn't last long at all before someone buggers it up by, you know...
No.
yeah, telling a contradictory Hawkman story in most cases.
I imagine that.
clearly, I mean, there are big deals in the characters who died, like Supergirl died in the Crisis.
That was huge.
Yeah, the first big death of the Crisis in issue 7, and one of the most iconic covers in all of comicdom,
with
Superman holding her her body. And you know, how do they follow that up? They kill the Flash. So Barry Allen, and he was never seen again.
Wait a minute.
Well, for 25 years he was dead, which is a very good run in comic book universe.
It is, and yes.
Probably not possible in these days now.
No.
But so big changes like that. I mean, obviously Cole died, Cole with a K from the New Teen Titans. And the Titans have never been the same since they lost that character that Marv created to kill.
Clearly.
But, you know, as terms of, you know, they're the big deals about the Crisis. They're the things you think of as, you know, and coming out of that, you know, Barry was still dead. Supergirl was still dead for quite some time. It took a while for them to introduce a new type of Supergirl. So they did away with Superboy coming out of this, and they, you know, buggered up the Legion of Superheroes completely because it was all Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes. And suddenly they said in Burn Superman, Superman was never active as a boy. So how do you reconcile those stories? And they didn't really know how to, and they did all sorts of things to try and do that. So, you know, there's some of the problems that created, and there's some of the good things that came out of it. Like Wally West couldn't step up as the Flash unless, you know, Barry was dead.
True.
So, true. Win-win.
That's big deal for me, being a bit of a Green Lantern fan and with the whole mythos around them, was the storyline involving Crona. The Owen, who decided that he wanted to see the creation of the universe and how he kind of mucked things up a little bit. But coming out of that was the story behind why the Guardians formed the Green Lanterns. And I thought that was really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, I wasn't sure where you're going with it. I mean, that Crona stuff, I mean, it comes up again and again on these, you know, universal scale stories. And you
That's
know.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like it's mythic in my head that I can't remember the first time I ever saw Crona and, you know, the hand reaching through the portal to the beginning of creation. So, yeah, it's very cool and interesting. Mm. One thing that's always puzzled me about the Crisis on Infinite Earths is you've got, like, the Monitor is the one helping the heroes. Yes. And they wanted to have a villain. I believe they used the name Anti-Monitor as a placeholder, and then time ran out and they didn't have a better name. So Anti-Monitor must go down as one of the all-time worst names for a villain ever. But I was racking my brain trying to think of what's a better name for him, and I'm pretty much Marv. I can't think of a better name for the Anti-Monitor off the top of my head at the moment.
Well, in Wolfman's introduction in the trade paperback collection, he goes on about how in his youth he created a villain called the Librarian. So that could have been worse. Or well, it could have been the Anti-Librarian.
The Anti-Librarian?
Yeah.
The Loud Person. That could...
The Late Fee Man. Oh, gosh.
So, I mean, what do you think is the single biggest deal about the Crisis? What's the one moment that hits you every time?
I think the big final battle with the Anti-Monitor. All throughout the series, there are these wonderful moments where Wolfman has basically gone into the DC sandpit and just taken every action figure he can find and put them in bizarre situations, such as where you've got, you know, Anthro in the Bear Cave turning up in the Bat Cave and, you know, wandering up into Wayne Manor. Or, you know, you've just got heroes from completely different eras and dimensions and time periods all working together. And that all comes to this big, massive boss fight with the Anti-Monitor at the end of it there. And that's just, that's awesome to me. That's like, that set the stage for all future big kick-ass events that came after, I think.
Yeah, good one. Yeah, I think the bit I love the most, I mean, my favourite part of the whole story is probably the I think it's around issue 8 where they think they've defeated the Anti-Monitor and they've roped in all the heroes and multiple villains to help them. And the tide has turned. It looks like the Anti-Monitor has been defeated. And then all the villains suddenly join together and attack all the heroes. And it's a great third act twist, you know?
Yes. That's actually an awesome cover as well with all the villains on the front. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good point to talk about the art. I mean, one thing that George Perez is unrivaled as far as being able to chuck a lot of characters on a cover and make them all look dynamic and interesting and detailed and, you know, stunning. So, you know, and Crisis really wrote the book on how to do epic covers, you know, with thousands of characters. I mean, the man obviously, you know, is incapable of not doing a story without 120% effort, you know.
Yeah.
Puts everything into it every time on every page, and it must be an absolute nightmare for the inkers.
Yes.
And then you got the colorists as well and all. Uh-huh. Oh, imagine doing that. I mean, but it really is spectacular. I mean, there were some printing issues with the original issues and that everything didn't come out nicely, and you know, they've done some experimentation with printing styles that you know, was which backfired, but I mean, We reap the rewards by having trades of it today in hardcovers and things like that, where everything's been cleaned up and you can get digital copies of this one on Comixology and stuff like that. So, the art is just staggering. So I want to touch briefly on the legacy of what came out of this. So pretty much the big things that I can think of is they introduced the Charlton characters that they'd bought into the DC Universe. So Blue Beetle and Captain Atom and The Question and Peacemaker, not so much, but all these characters sort of became part of the DC Universe after this. It really did create the template for events where you change things and tie in all the books. And, you know, they would have learned a lot of lessons from, you know, this is how it will work well, this is the things that didn't quite work. And, you know, like there's so much editorial coordination and tying things in. And, you know, if people are going to use the monitor, they've got to get out character sheets of what he looks like to people so they can use him. And, you know, and in some cases, there wasn't much focus on his personality. But this was a classic a fixer. So, you know, let's fix the DC Universe, you know, streamline everything. But it was also a classic launcher because they got to the point where, okay, everything's been fixed. The DC Universe is a single whole, makes sense now. The history is, you know, continuous and, you know, it's not spread across multiple Earths with different time periods happening at the same time. You know, so they say, okay, we're going to launch books. And so they did, you know, the Superman launch, incredibly successful. You know, I'm not crazy about John Byrne's work on all comics, but his Superman stuff is damn good. You know, you got New Flash, you got Wonder Woman, even little things like the death of Dove, which paves the way for the new, you know, Dove with Hawk and Dove. You know, I love that sort of stuff. Yeah, and all these things came out of it. I mean, there were some books that they kind of didn't restart. You know, it's like Swamp Thing was going full steam ahead with this, you know, intricate story, and you wouldn't want to, you know, stop that and say, okay, start again. And there's things like the Batman universe where it just got a bit messy as, like, you know, there was a very wishy-washy line between old and new with the Batman's books. But there's so much came from this. And, you know, one thing about the Crisis, it's still being mentioned today. Like, you know, lots of DC events are named after it. You know, you have the, precursor to this, there were the crises where the JSA and the JLA met. You know, and this was sort of the culmination of all that in the biggest story ever. But we still have things like Infinite Crisis and Crisis on Crisis in Time, or, you know, Zero Hour as it became to be known.
Zero Hour, yeah.
Yeah.
Identity and Crisis, Infinite Identity Crisis.
Lots of them.
They really love their crises, these.
You know, and even to the point where, you know, the very first episode of the Flash TV show, it had Crisis mentioned. There was the newspaper from the future with, you know, Red Skies and the Flash dying in the Crisis.
Yep.
They haven't got to very that cool. yet, but yeah. So lots of big deals about this. So anyway, if you want to know more about the Crisis, like we are doing a very hit and run on it, but Chris and Reggie at Cosmic Treadmill, they did 5 episodes on it, so episodes 50 to 54. there's a whole podcast about it on Two True Freaks Network called The Crisis Tapes. Even last week, DC Comics Presents show, they did The Crisis. Russell did that. And there's the Tales of the JSA, just Society of America. That was done by Michael Bailey and Scott Gardner. They did they got Crisis Burnout. They did four episodes on The Crisis and did the first four issues, and then they stopped it about 2 years ago. So
oh, dear.
Oh, dear. Yeah. So there's lots out there on The Crisis. Just do a search for it. You'll find something if you want to know more. Or just go and get the book and read it. Read it for yourself.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. If you haven't read it, go and pick it up, because it's, I guess, essentially the kickoff point for DC as we know it today. Even though, yes, there have been reboots and resets along the way, I think this is a great starting point for a really good glimpse at what came before.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess we're up to the scoring part. So, So, Mike, what do you think about its eventiness?
It's pretty big. I'm going to give it 8 out of 10 for eventiness. I think it'd get a 10, except I think I wonder if 12 issues were really needed. And as much as I love DC events, it's also a bit of a double-edged sword in that events became such a necessity.
Right, yeah.
And that they had to be done, and the stakes always had to be high. And as you said, there had to be massive editorial collaboration behind the scenes to make sure it didn't suck, you know? So, and I say that being a fan of DC and their events, I think, yeah, because not all of them are great. A lot of them are really good. Some of them are great. But yeah, it's, for me, it's a bit of a double-edged sword. So I think 8 out of 10 is pretty fair. How about you?
Yeah, I'm going to give it 8. I think it's the core book that makes this event. Like, it really is a fantastic read all the way through, and you never feel like, oh, I wish I had this tie-in issue to, you know, understand this better. You never feel like you're missing any part of it. But on the flip side, you know, tie-in issues are part of the fun of events, and I think it's not always that strong with this one. So, you know, there's nothing really, oh, I'd like to know a lot more about that. I'll go over there and, you know, dive in deep on it. It doesn't seem to give you that as you go. So I'm feeling 8 as well. So
okay.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on the writing of Crisis?
Okay. Well, I don't hate to say it, I don't think it's aged that well. It's fairly
No, it hasn't.
It's fairly melodramatic. And I think the book suffers from not having any real point of view characters. It has like 100 point of view characters instead of 2 or 3.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're not feeling anyone's emotional stakes that strongly. Like, you know, the death of Barry Allen, you know, and the way that affects Wally, you know, you kind of see it, you don't feel it. And I think it has a lot more weight if you're really invested in the DC universes, you know, the multiverse before this point. But if you're coming back to it, you know, it's just like, oh, that happened. It's like, you know, seeing it on the news rather than being there as such. So I'm feeling the writing is about a 7 on this. 7. So, yeah. And there's some characters that are just damn annoying, like Pariah and all the constant crying. And
which is a shame, oh, no. Because yeah, that's what he's like. But he's also kind of made out to be this important role in the thing. But anyway, yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Fair score. I'm going to give it a 6.
Ooh.
Purely because I think it went on a couple of issues longer than needed. The good thing is I really like seeing thought bubbles in comics. So, and I hadn't seen any in ages. So, yeah, I think a 6 from me.
Wow. Okay. On to the art side. I think you can't fault the art at all. It's, you know, it is brilliant craftsmanship and, you know, elegant and intricate and elaborate and epic, and it captures all the characters, draws them all brilliantly and puts them all in, you know, these environments that are amazing, and, you know, the scale of it is enormous. It's, you know, it's widescreen and it's amazing, and the art is the single most strongest element of this event.
Yes.
Yeah, easily. So I have to give it a 10. I can't give it anything less than a 10.
I will be boring and agree with you completely. The art's the best part of this event. It's fantastic to see such a wide range of characters in bizarre settings. You know, against this giant calamity. It's just great. I wish there were like, it makes me want to get out action figures and reenact scenes from it because
yeah.
It's the art's so inspiring. So yeah, I'll give it a 10 as well.
Wow. Yeah. And as far as the impact and the legacy and the, you know, the changes that it initiated and, you know, created and the ripples that have been felt, I think this is the big one. I think this book, you know, it's still being measured against today, and there's still things that, you know, people still talk about post-crisis and pre-crisis, you know, the mm-hmm. everything that's come from this, it still kind of matters. And, you know, we're seeing it in other media now, and we're, you know, like The Flash. Yeah, so I think it, you know, it sort of is dying down a bit. Like, I think when the DC Universe rebooted with the New 52, I think it sort of took a little bit away from the crisis, but I think Rebirth sort of brought it all back a bit more, and you had the, you know, you even had the echoes of what happened to Wally in the, you know, trying to get out of the Speed Force, you know.
True, yep.
Being reminiscent of what's happening with Barry in Crisis. So I think the impact and legacy of it is, it's nearly perfect. So I'm going to give that a 9 out of 10.
Ooh, okay. Yeah. I'm going to give it an 8 because, yes, it's awesome. It set the scene for big events to come. However, some of those events were undone eventually, which I find annoying. But I know it's also a business and, you know, people go, oh, I want Supergirl back, or, you know, bring back the Flash or whatever. So, yeah, I really like events, but at the same time, there are things that bug me, like the rebooting and things being undone. So I think, yeah, 8 from me.
It may just be that the Crisis on Infinite suffers from that the most because it's the first one. So it's had more time, you know, for things to happen. Like 85, what is that, 32 years later or 33 years later now.
Yeah.
So, whew. Yeah.
Whew, indeed.
Yeah. So, anyway, so part of this now is we invited a guest to submit their thoughts about the crisis and their scores. So, in this case, it's Moby, Stefan Mobus, our mate, and he sent us in quite an essay about it. So, I'll just get into that for us. So, he said, I think you already know about this, but Crisis of Infinite Earths holds a special place in my heart. I started my adult comic reading life in early 1984 when in a small gaming convention and book fair, I happened upon a comic seller and struck up a conversation. The seller asked me who was my favorite comic character when I was a child, and I mentioned that I used to love The Flash, and he loaned me about 3 issues of the Carrie Bates run. Would have been a bit before the trial of the Flash story, most likely. And I was hooked. I read and collected as much Flash and then the Justice League and New Teen Titans, etc., along the way to picking up the first issue of Crisis on Infinite Earths as it came out. So it was a perfect storm for me timing-wise. Here I was with a burgeoning passion for the Barry Allen Flash character, only to have him die saving the universe in the most heroic of ways, and all in the days before previews, spoilers, when you would just get hints of what's to come in the book itself, you know, the visage of Barry appearing before Batman and not in a good state, for example. You can imagine what impact this event had on me at the time. Just on the Flash family alone, this series created the idea of Saint Barry. It's also one of the clearest, earliest, best examples of legacy in the passing of the Flash costume from Barry to Wally, and in the event name being a nod to the classic JLA-JSA crossovers, something that is widely recognized in later years as a strength of the DC line, which sets it apart from other publishers. The writing is dramatic, still on the wordy side, as is Wolfman's wont, but this is some of his best work, and there is obviously care and thought and love for the characters on display, even as they are being killed in some cases, as evidenced by the paraphrasing of a section of the William Knox poem Mortality as a Barry Allen epitaph in issue 8. Oh, why should the spirit of mortal be proud? Like a fast-flitting meteor, a fast-flying cloud, a flash of the lightning to a break of the wave. He passes from life to the rest in his grave. Wow. And as far as the art, George Perez is an absolute top of his game here. He is right up there in my eyes as far as favorite pencilers. The cover to issue 7 is considered iconic and has been homaged several times, and the cover to issue 8 is just as good in my eyes. It wasn't printed on the best paper stock from memory, but that can be somewhat remedied if you get hold of a decent collected edition. This series is worth it. He said, I love the view this series gave you across the entire DC universe, all in one title, and I love the use of the Psycho Pirate for a long time afterwards, the only one reportedly able to remember the event. So he gives it, his score's coming. So 10 out of 10 for eventiness.
Okay.
And then he gives it writing, 9 out of 10. Art and covers, 10 out of 10. And impact, legacy, 10 out of 10. Wow. So if we add all our scores together, we get 120. Now, we don't want to get 120, so we're going to halve his scores. So and we'll round up. So basically, he gave it 5 out of 5 for eventiness, 5 out of 5 for writing, 5 out of 5 for art covers, and 5 out of 5 for impact and legacy. So that gives him a score of 20. And so overall, our scoring of Crisis on Infinite Earths is 86 out of 100.
Nice.
So if we go to the ladder now, we can see that of the episodes that we've done, Crisis on Infinite Earths has a score of 86, and that makes it the number one event.
Well done, Crisis.
At this stage. Okay, right. So that's it for our first episode. So we'll be back in 2 weeks' time for another DC OCD. If you want to hear us talk about the Doom Patrol, we'll be back next week. Mm. So, tell us what you think. If you want to send us your comments, we are on Twitter at DCOCDcast, and you can send us emails to DCOCDcast@gmail.com. So, thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Paul. It's been good fun. Interesting scoring on Crisis, but yeah, I think it's fair.
Yeah, I think it's not much surprising there. But next time on DCOCD, we will be talking about Legends from 1986.
Nice.
We'll catch you then.
See ya.